Hello and welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast, where we throw light on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. In today's episode, we hear from Noreen Blanluet, co-founder of the Co-Production Network for Wales, which is an independent not-for-profit whose aim is to effect positive change in public services and communities through citizen involvement and co-production. When asked about what it means to place citizens at the heart of policymaking, she introduced the concept of co-production, what it is and what it is not, when it works and when it doesn't, and lastly, why we need to do it right. Now, what I loved about this conversation was that it was one of those chats that brought head and heart together. So we appreciate the complexity of things and processes, and also understand that we live and work with living beings, people. And that's an important distinction to draw out in policy making or anything to do with economic development. Anyway, let me not give too much away. Have a listen. Noreen, thank you so much for joining me today. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on here. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. I'm delighted to be here with you today.
Of course, my pleasure. So I know we don't have a lot of time and I've been accused of talking more than 30 minutes when I say I'm always going to keep it under 25. So I'm going to head straight into this episode. But, you know, I mentioned how I came across your work. I was doing a course on apolitical and watched a video where you talked about putting citizens at the heart of policymaking. And I wanted to start there. So a lot of the times, right, our models of governance, right, in places like the UK and South Africa, in Ghana, you know, where I'm from, are meant to be sort of democratic, right? This governance of the people, by the people, for the people. But if we're to be honest, sometimes it seems like it privileges some, like a select few, and their interests over others, and has created sort of this bit of this yawning, like a crocodile mouth gap between citizens and those who govern them in terms of, you know, what comes out in policy. Can you share a little bit about, in terms of the work that you're doing, what it means to put citizens at the heart of policy making, why it's essential even, and why we struggle to do that often?
Ooh. I just
loaded it up for you at the
questions.
Start.
Absolutely. Right. So the first thing I want to echo and pick up in what you said, you're talking about these democratic models, you know, by people and for people. And I think it might be useful to distinguish different kinds of democratic processes. And I'm thinking particularly representative democracy versus participative democracy. And right. With the electoral process, and, you know, we choose the people who will represent us at local, regional, national level, devolved level. Maybe I'm in Wales in the UK, so we have a devolved government, but we're also under the UK government. So we have all these different levels of representation, representatives that we vote for in different elections. And through that process, we delegate our power to them. And they make decisions on our behalf. And there's a whole other podcast conversation to be had about whether they make wise decisions or not, and whether this model works or not. But that is the model of representative democracy. And where my work lies is in a different model of democracy, which is more participative democracy. Mm. And participative democracy is it's more about having people involved in a lot of the decision making, and, you know, participating in the decisions that shape their lives. And I think my footnote here, my caveat is that it doesn't need to be either representative or participative, but those two ways of doing democracy actually complement each other quite well, and they're useful at different levels. Yeah. And so if you were looking at, you know, national level, where decisions have to be made for a whole population, it's very difficult. And I'll come full circle to talk about how we do it and what these processes look like and how people can get involved. But it's more difficult to have everybody involved in every decision at national level, because it's just so many decisions and so many people. So there's effectiveness in choosing people who will, you know, hopefully, in theory, you know, get the right information, get the right expertise, the right guidance, mm-hmm. the right advice to make wise decisions for everybody. But there are levels and there are situations where actually having people involved in these decisions really helps. And that's the bit that I want to talk about today. That's the bit where I work.
Yeah.
So we call it co-production in the UK, and I know in Europe, I've seen a lot of European research, people often talk about co-creation. There's different words and terms that kind of floating around that refer to these sorts of things. Sometimes people talk about involvement, sometimes people talk about participation, sometimes people talk about engagement, co-design. There's a sort of... there's overlap and synergies between all these terms, but also there's different definitions depending on who you're talking to. Mm. So if I define the way I use them for the purposes of this conversation, my footnote is that if you talk to somebody else who's using the same term, they may mean something slightly different, and that clarity when we start the conversation is quite important. So when I talk about co-production, it's about having the citizen voice really at the heart of what we do, and it's really a partnership working between citizens and professionals, or, you know, to broaden the definition, is anybody who's receiving a service or accessing a service and anybody who's delivering or providing a service. It's co-production happens at the interface between these two groups, and I keep them deliberately quite broad as definitions, because I might be, you know, have a professional hat and work in a local authority, for example. So I would be a person providing a service, but in my own life, I'm also a citizen and I would be accessing other services. So it's very, you know, situation specific and context specific, who's on the professional side and who's on the citizen side in that dynamic relationship. But co-production is about bringing these groups of people together and sharing power, sharing decision-making, making decisions together about the services, about what affects people's lives. That's where I work. And in Wales, we also have a devolved legislative context that's quite encouraging to do co-production. And we also have an act called the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act that was published in 2015. And that act talks about involvement. But the vibe is really, you know, what we mean is the same thing as what I describe as co-production. So here in Wales, we talk a lot about co-production and involvement in the same breath, or I often say involving people in co-production. So that's how I talk about it. And I spent ages on a definition, but I think that clarity is quite important, because sometimes people say, oh, yeah, no, we sent out a survey to everybody, it's fine, we've co-produced it. And I'm just like, no, you kind of missed the point. It's really not what we're talking about.
Yeah.
If we look at citizens getting involved in policy making, that's quite an interesting use case, because co-production could apply to literally anything across the charity sector and the public sector and government. Is anything that's a service that supports people's lives, how can it can be improved in some way by co-producing some aspects of it with the people who are going to be using it. So it could be an one-to-one conversation, you know, if somebody's in hospital, you know, what's your journey of care looking like, or what's the support that you need when you're going home, or, you know, how do your family carers look after you? All of these can be very co-productive conversations. We can use co-production to redesign or transform a service. You know, we're finding that, you know, this isn't working for people. Well, let's ask the people who need it what would work better for them. You know, professionals always have an expertise and a perspective to bring, but this is also about bringing in the service user and the citizen's perspective on an equal level, having that parity and building that reciprocal understanding so that together we can design something better because more perspectives on the problem. And at strategic level, you know, it's like, where does the organization go, or what are our strategic priorities? So really, we can build co-production in every level. And policy making is probably the most strategic level of co-production that we can implement it at, because this is about making decisions, you know, whether it's local government policy or national government policy. But these are decisions and structures that are going to affect a lot of people's lives. So with my massive preamble is leading me to this point where I'm saying, okay, so if your intention is to co-produce a policy, then what, how do you go about it, and what do you, you know, what are the bits that you really need to co-produce? And I have three different thoughts that I want to tell you all at the same time, jostling in my brain to come out.
I can see them milling around over there.
You can see the cogs turning. I guess what I want to say at this stage, which will lead me into these different distinctions, is co-production isn't a panacea, and it's not one size fits all. It's not the magic solution that we need to blanket apply to every decision or every, you know, project development, policy development. And co-production doesn't work for everything.
And one of the questions that I had for you is, when do you co-produce and when do you not co-produce?
Absolutely. I think now might be a good time to unpack that a little bit. And one of the models that I find really helpful to understand when to co-produce and when not to co-produce is complexity theory and models around different types of challenges. And when you look at complexity theory, it's a fairly recent academic discipline, and it's still developing, but it's a way of looking at the kinds of problems that we look at, or at least the bit of complexity that I'm interested in. There's all sorts of like statistical modeling and looking at the murmurations of starlings and lots of math and all of that. Is like, this is great and super technical. I need just this little corner here to illustrate my point. And the descriptions of problems and challenges and how the best response, what the best response is to deal with them is, there's broadly, you could class them broadly into four dimensions: simple problems, complicated problems, complex problems, and chaotic problems or challenges. And simple ones are very straightforward. You have, it's easily defined. You have a way to solve it. An example would be, you know, baking a cake. Not anything too fancy, just a basic cake. So you know what you're doing. You've got a recipe. Somebody's written down a recipe. You've gone and found it. You've got a process that's linear. So you have to get all your ingredients and your equipment first. You have to do all the steps in the right order. But if you follow all the instructions, there's a right and a wrong way to do it. So if you do it right, then you'll get the result you expect. So it's predictable. It's linear and it's predictable. And there's an end point. Once you've got your cake, you've finished this process.
Right.
So that's a simple sort of challenge. A complicated challenge is more of that. So it might be much, much more technical. It could be like building a rocket. So you need many more materials, planning sessions, blueprints, lots of planning and designing up front. But there's also a phased process, a linear process that you need to do the planning, then get the materials, then do the build, then test it, then launch it. And you've got to do them in the right order. You've got to make sure you have the right equipment. You probably need many more skills, people who are more trained in this, who've made it that technical speciality versus, you know, picking up a recipe that with a bit of practice anybody can do. But broadly speaking, you can either recruit those skills into your organization, or you can contract them in, so you can find the right people who have the specialist technical knowledge to build the rocket, and then you can launch your rocket and you can put your rover on Mars. And so there's also an end point, you know, there's a task and finish element of this. The next dimension, and this is where it gets really interesting and really relevant to what we're talking about. So thank you for bearing with me through this, what looks like a detour, but I promise it's relevant.
Yeah, it's incredibly helpful, even for me.
The complex type of challenge is where there's no recipe, nobody's got the magic solution, not magic, but, you know, the one best practice solution that will be the perfect answer, and everything keeps changing. And a good analogy for a complex, or a good example of a complex challenge, is raising a child. So there's thousands of books written about how you raise a child, but there isn't one book that's really cracked it and gone, this is the ultimate solution. There isn't an ultimate solution, because humans are humans, and whatever you do with your first child might not work with your second child, or might not work in the same way. And and there are no sort of like there are no easy solutions. And the reason for that is every human being is an adaptive network system. Each one of us is networked with each other, with our colleagues, our friends, our families, our natural environment, our built environment, all these different factors in our personal ecosystems. And we're adaptive because when something shifts in our environment, then we shift and we adapt in return. But because we've adapted, then we have an own knock-on effect on something else, and that adapts and so on. And so I do this with my hands a lot. You know, I know this is an audio medium, but what I'm doing is I'm holding this invisible ball with my hands. So I'm like turning over and over because these things
it's fascinating because what I'm using in my mind is a Rubik's Cube.
Yes.
To some extent. So you're doing that, and in my head, that's how I think about these things. Literally, it's like you're fixing this one thing and the bottom is just going and shifting.
Exactly.
And so you're doing this and you're talking about a ball, and I'm like, yeah. Oh, a Rubik's Cube.
Yes, exactly. So you've got this process going on. You shift something else shifts, and then because something else shifts, etc. And it's constantly, you know, in dynamic balance. And complex challenges are things to do with living beings, with humans, with relationships, with, you know, big system things like loneliness and poverty and inequality and even democracy. All of these things are about people's lives and about how we live together in society and in relationship to one another. These are all complex challenges. And especially in policy circles, we talk a lot about wicked problems and wicked challenges. They're the ones, they're complex challenges. They're the ones where there's no easy solution, there's no, or even difficult solution, but there is no straightforward plan that we can just design and roll out, because otherwise we would already have done it and fixed it. But what we're left in terms of wicked challenges are the ones that everything keeps changing all the time. We'll address one factor and then something else changes, or it's just so big that by the time we've addressed this, then something else has moved the goalposts, and then we have to address that, and then something else has shifted. And so we're dealing with big societal problems. They are complex challenges. And in complex challenges, you can't plan your way out of them. We can't, you know, design something that's going to be the ultimate solution and then just roll it out, not in the way you can for something technical or for a build, or, you know, to build a house or to build a rocket. You do the planning, then you roll it out. But what traditional sort of strategy and policy processes have been is that somebody in an office somewhere is tasked with solving a challenge, which a lot of the time is a complex wicked challenge, and then they'll do all the research they can, and they'll try and get experts in, and then they'll figure it out, and they go, right, I know everything I need to put into this, then I'll write this plan, and I'll write the implementation plan for this strategy. And then maybe, you know, there's a statutory process that says, oh, we have to go out to consult, we have to put it out to consultation. But by that point, you spent hundreds of hours of working on this thing, so it goes out to consultation, and if people even know about it, we can have a whole other conversation about the accessibility of policy processes. Actually, it's probably a part of this conversation for in a minute. But if people at that point look at the consultation and respond and say, well, this bit doesn't work and that doesn't work for us, and actually you're asking the wrong questions or you're solving the wrong problem, there's been such an investment already of research and bringing in experts and writing strategies and developing implementations plans, that all you're going to do in response to this consultation feedback is you're going to tinker around the edges and try and look like you've adjusted things in response, but you're not going to fundamentally change what you've designed. So just for completeness, by the way, in the complexity theory model, the fourth dimension is chaotic challenges, where it's unexpected, it's big, it moves very fast. But that's not really the business as usual for when we're in public policy. So I'll leave that one out. People can read up about it or look at that. There's a lovely podcast called The Clock and the Cat, where that talks about, ooh, the clock is the complicated type of challenges and the cat is the complex living kind of challenges. And I have forgotten the person's name who runs the podcast, but they used to work in government and local authorities, and so they have this policy lens on things. It's a very nice podcast. So how do we make policies that work for people, and when do we involve people, and at what stage, and when do we not involve people, and why? Because although I am keen to stress that co-production isn't for everything and everyone all of the time, I don't want that to be an excuse to not do it, because there are times where co-production adds so much value and so much insight that actually it'd be really wasteful not to to leverage it. It's about choosing wisely when to use it, when not to use it. Co-production will give you a lot of insights about people's lives, what they live with, what their lived experience is, how they're likely to live with the kinds of decisions that you're looking to make or the kinds of policies you're looking to write. But people don't know how to write policy because they're not policy professionals. People don't know what goes into a policy or the language that a policy needs to be written in. And so there are things that we can meaningfully ask people about. There are questions we can ask people that would be meaningful and they can answer with their experience, their lived experience. And there are things that we can ask people that's not meaningful and that we shouldn't ask people. For example, you know, not a non-policy analogy, but if you're building a website, you're going to talk to people about what information do you need to see and how does it make sense to you? How will you search? What kind of categories do we need to have on here? And how will we help you with this information in a way that really works for you? But we're not expecting them to say, oh, this line of code should be like at on line 5, not on line 10. And that's what we need to bear in mind with policies. We don't want to ask them the technical bit, you know, the technical process of building a policy. But what we need to ask them is that input about you're going to be living with this policy or this set of decisions. We're also bringing a bunch of other data and experts and people, you know, if you're writing an environmental policy, you're probably going to have environmental experts and climatologists and people who are specialists in biodiversity and nature and all sorts to input. And you're going to be relying on big data sets to look at what's going on and what decisions need to be made. But you're also going to be talking to people about what does it mean? What does climate change mean in your life? And how are you dealing with the rising costs of energy? And how about food poverty? Mm-hmm. And what is it like living in a food desert? And what needs to happen? And what does nature mean to you? And are you aware of biodiversity? And what matters to you in that respect? And so you need to triangulate these different sources of information, the sort of expert and data, with the lived experience as well. And the more policy is going to have an impact on people's lives, the more they need to be in that conversation, but really upstream. Before you start drafting your policy, do it at that research stage where you're trying to get input to get a shape in your head about what is it that this is going to mean for people. And then as you go through the process of actually, you know, that funnel of policy making where you draft and you refine and you refine and you draft and so on, then the feedback you get from citizens and people becomes more, you know, the fine-tuning and the tweaking. But because you've had a lot of big input at the beginning, you know, these big ideas and these big concepts, then you should be on the right path by the time you get to consultation stage. I think I'll pause here. Yeah. I've poured out a big chunk of my brain.
That's helpful. Can you share?
Yeah.
No, you have. And I think it's actually been very helpful, especially the sort of the examples that you use. Can you share some examples of like successful, you know, co-production initiatives in policy making, maybe in a little bit about, you know, what made them effective, maybe versus when they weren't exactly effective in other examples? I think that would also be quite useful to understand. Yes.
The first thing I want to say is, in terms of the policy work that I've seen so far and that I've been involved in so far, actually, I should probably give a little bit of context. I work for the co-production network in Wales as a consultant, and we do a lot of projects with all sorts of different organizations helping the teams along their co-production journey. So we do get approached to work on all sorts of things, from, you know, small charities to government teams. And so we have been doing some work in different policy areas. And so what I would say is it's not usually black and white in terms of this is a great co-produced policy or this is like a terrible, not at all. Well, actually, Those do exist. As I say, this is a terrible, not a co-produced at all policy. But again, you know, this is a bit too simplistic. Just because something's not co-produced doesn't make it necessarily terrible. Mm-hmm. But co-production is always, you know, the ideal co-production outcome with involving people at the right people at the right time and the right way. Our aspiration also has to exist in the real world, in systems that are not designed for early conversations, for co-produce exploration, for dealing with complexity. And a lot of systems and processes are designed in a linear way for complicated challenges. And we're trying to exist around these complex challenges within a complicated framework. And so in practice, even though there are lots of policies that haven't been co-produced and that could be better, there's a number of factors that, I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm not tarring all these policy writers and saying, yeah, they're all, you know, they've all done an awful job. Is they had, they exist in a set of constraints and systems of government that are not, they can not be conducive depending on where they're at and their teams and the timescales they have and all that kind of thing. So some of the policy work we've done has been quite light touch and quite short. So I would not say we've co-produced the whole policy by any stretch of the imagination. But we've managed to get citizen voice injected at some key point so that the insights they added was really helpful for the people who are writing the policy. At that sort of level, it's a bit more user research stroke participative research than co-production, because the policymakers will kind of listen and weigh things up and then take all the data away and then write the policy. So, you know, we were saying earlier, by people, for people. If you think of the spectrum of doing two people or doing four people or doing with people, that's a little bit more doing for. You know, we'll ask questions, we'll listen, but then we'll take away the information, we'll write up the policy based on what we've learned, and then we do it on behalf of, you know, the nation. Whatever, which is what tends to happen in national governments, even our devolved governments, because they have to make decisions that apply to 3 million people in Wales. So there will always be an element of we're doing for people. But hopefully by involving citizen voice at the bits in the bits that really matter, we're avoiding doing two people blindly. Doing two people, you know, in the broader picture of public services, doing two people is sometimes important and useful when people are in situations of crisis or where there's issues of safety and, you know, risk to life. Then it's important that the people who are trained to do what they know how to do, do it. You know, if paramedics are on the scene, they have to do it to the patient. The patient's fainted, they're not in a position to co-produce the journey of care. You know, so I'm not saying doing two people is always banned, but doing two blindly and going, we're the experts, we sit in an office and we know best. And so we're just going to write this and it's going to suit everybody. And if it doesn't suit everybody, well, that's just tough. You know, that's the worst, doing two people. And that's what we really want to avoid. And so by involving citizen voice and putting that in the policy process, then we can hope to do four people in a very informed way. And the best examples I've seen of a co-produced policy is moving towards doing with. There'll always still be an element of, at some point, there's going to be some civil servants who'll have to take away all this material and write it up into like a policy format for it to be submitted and go through the policy processes that it does too. But the more citizens can be involved in more of the stages, or most of the stages, the more we're moving towards doing with in terms of doing policy. And the Anti-Racist Wales Action Plan, the work was carried out over the last couple of years, and it was very inspiring to see, because it's policy making, it's national policy, you know, it's quite large scale, it's national for Wales in our devolved context. But they took the time to do it, and that means they took the time to get it right. And they brought a group of citizens and stakeholders together, and with the right support, and really, you know, very attentive to the diversity and the range of input that they were getting, which is absolutely essential if you're writing an anti-racist action plan, to be honest, but should also happen if you're writing any other kind of action plan. And, you know, it works with more or less success, depending on, you know, who gets involved. But that was, I think, a good piece from what I've heard, and from the different perspective I've heard. I wasn't involved with this directly, but I saw it happen. I was like, yes, I'm very excited that this is happening. And it looks like they've done everything as well as they could have. They took the time, they didn't rush it. They make sure everybody could get involved properly. You know, everybody had a say, you know, the processes were put in place, and that's really hopeful. So, you know how earlier I was saying, oh, there isn't a, like, absolute perfect one and an absolute disaster one. There are things that come close I hesitate to say coming close to perfection, but it's certainly very good practice. And it's great because it sets the blueprint. It shows that it's what's possible, and it shows that if we've done it before, then we can do it again.
Well, that's helpful. And you know, one thing I want to come back to, which you mentioned earlier, is the accessibility of policy processes. And I know that in itself can be a whole podcast, and I'm cognizant of time. But very briefly, can you talk to me about that from your experience and the work that you've been doing? How have we, or how do, I guess, countries, and you can use the example of Wales, manage this? How do we bring it closer to the people? How do we know how accessible, like the, it's such a huge thing, because even for me, a lot of people don't really have much of a clue of like even the policy process, how they can even get involved. So I'm curious to know how other places have managed that, especially in instances where they've done a pretty good job with that.
I think we have a bit of a mixed picture in Wales. There's a mosaic of good practice, less good practice. I've seen some lovely examples. I've also seen some things I had high hopes for, and then I was like, oh, that turned out a bit disappointed. I think the underpinning of accessibility in my mind is having understanding and empathy for people's lives that you're hoping will access your thing. So if you, for example, if you're a local authority, you know, a local council, who are the people who you hope will be interacting with you and engaging and maybe even hopefully taking part in these policy processes? Who are they? What are their lives like? What are they interested in? Why should they engage? What's in it for them? You know, why should they even be interested? And I think at the moment, I haven't seen brilliant practice really in anywhere in Wales. So maybe somebody's listening going like, me, we've got a really good example where I am. And if they do, I really hope they get in touch and you know, like, set me right, show me great examples, share it, definitely. Because what I tend to see, especially in the more large and bureaucratic the organization is, the more processes are set in stone and the less empathetic they become. And so what I've seen so far is, if you want to get involved with your local authority, or if you want to have some kind of say in the decision making, well, you have to, as a citizen, I would have to conform and really figure out what the processes are. They're not written down and published publicly anywhere. Have to figure out who I need to talk to, how I can, you know, this is about me having to go and batter down the doors and go, listen to, I want my voice heard, you know, I want to be here, I want to understand, I've done my research, I have things to say. You'd need some kind of a running jump or a head start to be able to even get your head around the processes, and where do you get the advice? And this just so abstruse and behind closed doors, not deliberately, not because it's secret, but because it's just so hard to understand and it's not made easily understandable, that actually citizens don't engage with them. And then councils go, oh yeah, our citizens, they're quite apathetic, aren't they? They don't engage with our processes. Mm-hmm. It's like, is it any wonder? Have you even looked at your processes from a novice's point of view? You know, take off your bureaucratic glasses. You know, you're a person who knows the system inside out. Step outside of that for a minute and look at it from the outside. Yeah. It makes no sense if you're not in the system. So how can you expect people? Some people will take it upon themselves to be the activist who's like, I'm gonna teach myself how this works, I'm gonna find the right people to influence, I'm gonna use my battering ram and break my way into these systems because it's important, I have something important to say that needs to be in this conversation. And then they make all the effort and they're like, oh yeah, those are the difficult people who keep turning up. You can't win because the systems aren't designed to be accessible and inclusive. So, that was a little bit of a soapbox. In terms of accessibility of policy processes, they've got to think about purpose. Why should they be accessible? And I think that's maybe a question that doesn't get asked often enough. You know, there was some draft legislation I saw a few years back, which was about how local councils function, which is partly why all these examples are in my head. And the processes they were putting in place was like, oh, yeah, OK, so we'll live stream the council meetings. And, you know, if people want to feed something in, we'll have like the special form that they can submit. And I was just like, oh, great. But you still haven't figured out why should people get involved? You know, why does their voice matter? How do they feel that their voice matters? All of that needs to be thought through before, you know, form follows function. I always get them the wrong way around. So you need to understand why you want people, you know, that function of like, why do they want to be involved? Why does citizen voice bring value to the local authority, government, whoever? Why do our citizens' voice, their participation is important and it matters? And then how do we make it easy follows that. But if we just go, oh, yeah, we just need to, you know, allow people to watch our meeting. Well, we can allow people to watch our meeting. Doesn't mean they're going to watch it.
Exactly.
So there's a disconnect between, you know, we'll put processes in place, but actually why? And I think that connection, that relationship building, that interaction mm-hmm. with our citizens isn't always there. And that yeah. needs to come first.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's such a good point. Like why? Why should they be interested? And I think, goodness, yeah. like the couple of things ran. I'm like, yeah, now I'm like you with different things running around in my head. And then I just heard my alarm go off as well. So I know I've come to the end of my time for this chat. But Noreen, it's been fantastic. And I would love to continue this chat and explore the different ways that we can start to think about some of these things, especially for a majority of the people who listen to this podcast are an African audience. And these are some of the things we're hoping to get right, especially as we're looking at getting, you know, young people into some of these policy spaces to try to understand what needs to be done, how it needs to be done, and how can it be done better than it was in the past. So if you're okay with that, I would love to continue this chat another time with you. But in the meantime, thank you so very much. And I would just encourage everyone to learn a bit more about co-production, to check out the website. And there are different examples and different things that have been done across Wales that you can learn from. So Noreen, again, thank you so very much for the time. It's been absolutely lovely. And I look forward to this chat happening again sometime soon.
With pleasure. Thank you, Marie-Noelle. I've had a lot of fun pouring my brain out at you, but I'd be very happy to continue this conversation. That sounds great.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website www.thebrenthurstfoundation.org for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noelle on the Brenthurst Foundation podcast, and it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.